Case number 25-5054. Servier Pharmaceuticals LLC, appellants versus Robert F. Kennedy Jr. in his official capacity as Secretary of Health and Human Services, and Mehmet Oz in his official capacity as Administrator for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Mr. Perdue for the appellant, Mr. Janda for the appellees.
Good morning, counsel.
Morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. William Perdue on behalf of Servier Pharmaceuticals LLC. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Because the government has abandoned one of the two grounds for the decision below, this appeal comes down to a single question: whether the 2021 expenditures for TIBSOVO count towards, quote, the total expenditures under Part D for any one of the specified small manufacturer drugs of Servier. The answer to that question is yes, for three independent reasons. First, Servier undisputedly manufactured TIBSOVO in 2021, and the statutory analysis is product by product, not unit by unit. Second, even if the analysis were unit by unit, Servier, as the NDA holder, was legally responsible for every unit of TIBSOVO that was sold after April 1, 2021. And third, even if the NDA alone were not enough, CMS never explained its exclusive reliance on labeler codes, and on remand to the agency, Servier can present evidence of packaging and quality control activities that would satisfy even the most stringent reading of the statute. I'd like to start with our argument that the analysis is product by product rather than unit by unit.
Let me just ask you one thing. In a post-Loper-Bright world, why does it matter that the government is no longer arguing for one interpretation of the statute?
I assume you're referring to
the district court actually ruled on, so we have that now decision before us.
Yes. So I assume you're asking about the
agreement issue. Yeah.
The coverage gap discount program agreement requirement. Yes. So under Loper-Bright, it is this court's job to resolve the meaning of statutory provisions whose meaning is disputed by the parties before the court. It is not this court's job to tell parties what arguments to make to the court. And therefore, this court simply does not have a dispute before it about whether that particular provision of the statute.
There's a different rule that under which we can affirm a judgment on any ground supported by the record. And this is it's a legal question. We are post-Chevron, so there's no question about, you know, if you're in the gray area, the agency can go either way. There's just pure legal question presented that's potentially dispositive and, you know, to my judgment, looks a little bit more straightforward and cleaner than the one you all want us to address.
So I think the important point is that this is CMS's statute to enforce, and they have not put before this this court any argument that we have.
District court has put it before us.
I think there's no argument by the parties in front of this court that requirement hasn't been met. And I think for that reason, the requirement here is not just forfeited, is it affirmatively waived? And in addition, for that reason, actually affirming on that ground would violate the party presentation principle. I think the Supreme Court summarily.
That would invalidate our rule that Judge Katz has just referenced, that we can affirm on any basis preserved in the record. Wouldn't be the first time that we would do such a thing. I'm not saying we will in this case, but it wouldn't be the first time we've done that when the parties were focused elsewhere.
I think when this court does that, it is traditionally when an argument has been made below and made before this court, but the court below hasn't actually reached that issue. I can point this court to the Supreme Court's recent summary reversal just last month in Clark v. Sweeney. The Supreme Court summarily reversed the Fourth Circuit for violating the party presentation principle for reversing granting habeas relief in a case based on arguments that
they were reversing.
The Supreme Court reversed. That's correct.
Did the Fourth Circuit reverse the trial court?
I would have to check, Your Honor.
I thought you said that they had reversed something.
The Supreme Court summarily reversed the Fourth Circuit.
I mean, but it matters because this is a rule that allows us to affirm, not
alternative grounds to affirm are a lot easier for us to reach than alternative grounds to reverse, where you are running squarely into party presentation.
And the Fourth Circuit had reversed the trial court in that case. Off point.
So I think we have affirmative waiver here, not just forfeiture, affirmative waiver.
I get all that. And there are some prudential considerations cutting in favor of our not resting on that ground.
I think there's,
but there may be others. I mean, maybe others that cut the other way.
Well, if I could,
I think this is very straightforward.
Here's another reason. If you were sort of getting towards the merits of this argument, one of our arguments for why it was incorrect for the district court to determine that this requirement in the statute had not been met is that that was not the basis of CMS's decision, and therefore it violated Chenery. I think by
affirmative violate Chenery for a court to enforce a legally mandatory requirement. Chenery is all about discretionary decisions, and maybe pre-Loper-Bright close interpretive questions had an aspect of that, but not anymore. Covered by the CGDP agreement of such manufacturer in such year. If it means what it seems to say, you lose, period, full stop.
So I can give you yet another reason why I think this court should not affirm on that ground, which goes straight to the merits, skipping past Chenery, which I do think is a problem.
Well, let's just finish up on preservation. I'm interested in the merits, obviously, but okay. Just give me all you have on preservation, and then on prudential considerations, why you think we should not reach.
So I think there are three that it's affirmative waiver. It's affirmative waiver, not forfeiture. It's the party presentation principle. And it's the fact that this was not the basis of CMS's denial. So it would violate Chenery. If you go to the merits of this CGTP agreement requirement, I think both parties are correct on the merits here. So if you go back to 2021, the CGTP statute required Servier to include TIPSOVO on its coverage gap discount program agreement. But CMS at the time prohibited Servier from doing that. In its guidance under the coverage gap discount program agreement, CMS told parties like Servier to leave TIPSOVO on the old manufacturer's coverage gap discount program agreement and just work things out between themselves. That's what CMS told us to do. And so that's what we did do. Now, today, if CMS had followed the district court's interpretation of the statute, CMS would be telling Servier that actually Servier was violating the CGTP statute back in 2021. And as a result, it's also violating this statute now. And that kind of inconsistency is quintessentially arbitrary. If there are no further questions on the coverage gap discount program.
That sounds a little bit like an argument that the government's prior misinterpretation of a legal duty immunizes violations going forward.
I wouldn't characterize it that way. I think an important aspect of the way that CMS implemented the CGTP program back in 2021 is that it was implemented through agreements. So the requirement was that Servier had to include TIPSOVO on an agreement between Servier and HHS. Servier can't do that unilaterally, obviously. It's an agreement. They can only put things on the agreement that HHS will agree to. And HHS had guidance that said, we will not agree to that. We want you to keep it on the other agreement and work things out between yourselves. And so that's what we did.
The agreements are filed roughly a year out. They're filed before the year. The 2021 agreement would have been filed before January 1, 2021.
I don't recall whether the agreements are annual or updated or they're just ongoing. I'm not sure.
What I was going to ask, maybe you don't know, are they, once they're filed, is there some mechanism for mid-year amendments?
There is certainly a mechanism for adding new labeler codes to an existing agreement, but you can only add full labeler codes. You can't add an individual drug.
The labeler code identifying the manufacturer.
Right. So we could have put all of Agios's products on Servier's CGDP agreement in 2021, but that's not what the transaction was between Servier and Agios. We only bought the one drug, and so we couldn't put only the one drug that we bought onto Servier's.
You had bought the entire company. You could have amended the agreement to reflect all the new drugs of that company, and that would have solved this aspect of your problem.
Yes, we could have put the whole labeler code on, but we could not put on the individual drug that we bought. That was impossible.
I'm interrupting you, sorry, but the basic idea is kind of the greater power to amend mid-year as to all the products of an acquired company suggests a lesser power to do an amendment just for the one drug.
It's not a greater includes the lesser sort of situation, because what you put the mechanism for the amendment is you put the labeler code on the agreement, and the labeler code includes all of the drugs for that labeler, for that manufacturer.
The greater power to add a labeler code suggests a lesser power to add the drug code.
This
is a friendly line.
Yes. If you're asking whether CMS could have administered the program drug by drug so that we could have done this, yes, CMS, HHS absolutely could have done that, but they didn't. And there was nothing we could do about that unilaterally. We were at HHS and CMS's mercy at that time. If I'll now turn to the arguments that the parties have actually disputed before the court, I want to start with our argument that the analysis under the statute is product by product and not unit by unit.
Can I ask a fact question for you?
Yes, please.
This labeler code, where does it appear? Is it on the pill? Is it on the bottle? Is it on the palate? Is it?
It is not required to appear, but it is the FDA's regulations recommend that it appear on the box.
So if I buy an individual box of Tylenol or something, it'll have a labeler code on it?
It's recommended by FDA that it appear there, and it most likely would.
Okay. Otherwise, it is simply a reporting form. It's used for reporting.
It's a record keeping mechanism for FDA to keep track of different drugs.
And I thought like sales of drugs, at least to Part D beneficiaries, had to be reported to as well.
Yes. So there's
the labeler code.
Yes. So there's a mechanism called PDE data under Medicare Part D, in which the insurance company, after the fact, submits a record to CMS of all the transactions that have happened. It includes a lot of different pieces of information. What the drug was, what the price was, the copay, other information. And among the pieces of information there is the labeler code.
It's who manufactured the drug the Part D beneficiary received.
It's not actually the manufacturer. It's just the labeler code.
The labeler code identifies the manufacturer. You said that already. That's one of the things the labeler code does, is identify the manufacturer.
It can identify that. If I said that, I misspoke. The labeler code can identify the manufacturer, but that's not the only person it can indicate. It can indicate the repacker, the relabeler, and most relevant here, it can indicate the private label distributor.
A sale could be made without knowing who manufactured the pill. That seems really troubling in case there's any sort of adulteration or contamination processes.
It's not that it's
be identifying the manufacturer in this process.
It's not that it's not known. It's just that number that is on the box can refer to entities that performed a number of different roles in the manufacturing process. It can include the manufacturer, but it could be the relabeler, it could be the repacker, or it could be.
What would identify the manufacturer?
There's no.
They don't know who they've got to be tracing who manufactured a drug for.
It's not the labeler code that necessarily
does to do it.
I mean, our position would be that the NDA indicates who is really the manufacturer.
When the insurance company is providing information to Medicare or CMS about sales to Part D beneficiaries. It identifies the manufacturer as part of
it. It does not identify the manufacturer. It identifies the labeler code, and the labeler code may indicate the manufacturer, but it may not.
Okay, and then what if there's something wrong with the pills? How do they find who manufactured them? They know who's gotten it. Got it.
That's an FDA enforcement issue, and they have investigatory powers. They can look at who held the NDA, but they don't. The labeler code is not how they determine who is the manufacturer, because we quote and cite the FDA's NDC or National Drug Code regulations in our briefs, and it is clear as day expressed in those regulations that the labeler code can indicate entities that are not the manufacturer.
Where is that? Which regulation is that?
I don't have the site in front at my fingertips. I'll give it to you on rebuttal if that's all right.
But the other thing is that 21 CFR section 207.33C requires that if you're engaging in manufacturing, you're to update that label code within 30 days. So why wouldn't that be a necessary requirement, and that you couldn't wait 6 months to do that?
I'm sorry, I'm not following the question.
You're required to update the labeler code information within the 30 days. You didn't do so here. And then now you're seeking credit basically for that labeler code, you know, with respect to the sales.
So I'm not sure what the regulatory site you provided is referring to and what kind of update you're referring to. I can try to look at that on rebuttal, but the critical point I think for the court to understand is the labeler code does not necessarily indicate the manufacturer. It simply doesn't, and I think that's the district court cited and quoted.
What does it indicate? What's the point of the labeler code?
It indicates an entity that engaged in one of several possible activities with respect to that drug. It can indicate that it was the manufacturer. It can also indicate that it's the relabeler or the repacker or the private label distributor. And actually, in this case, the two labels we're talking about here, the Agios's label from 2021 and Servier's label from 2022, those labels indicate that Agios and Servier respectively were the private label distributor of this drug. And I think it's important for the court to remember that the manufacturing definition in the statute carves out distributors. So an entity that is a mere distributor is not a manufacturer under the statute. If I can go back to our main statutory argument, which I think sidesteps a lot of these issues, that is our argument that the analysis is product by product, not unit by unit. The key statutory language,
which is an odd framing. I mean, you have some nuggets, and there are aspects of this statute that one can read to support that, but it just seems like a very odd framing in the context where this is all about items that are paid for by Medicare or CMS. And they pay for individual increments of this drug. They don't pay for the product.
Yes, everyone agrees here that to calculate the relevant total expenditures here, you need to aggregate expenditures for multiple TIPSOVO units. The question before the court is, do you aggregate some TIPSOVO units, the ones with the right labeler code on them, or do you aggregate all of them? And our interpretation of the statute is simple. Total expenditures under...
Suppose for the sake of argument, just to untangle the statutory argument from the arbitrary and capricious argument. Just suppose for purposes of the question, we think the labeler code just means the manufacturer.
So
I know you dispute that, but
yes, and I don't think that the government actually disputes that either. The government's view is that the labeler code is a proxy for the, quote, actual manufacturer.
Okay, fair enough. Suppose it's a reasonable proxy. Or forget about the code and let's just talk about the substantive law.
Okay, I believe there are two questions there, so I'll try to answer them in turn. So even if you think that the labeler code is a reasonable proxy for the actual manufacturer, right, it is not the only possible proxy. Another one, for example, would be who holds the NDA. That is, in fact, how CMS itself today...
Sliding back into the arbitrary and capricious argument.
Yes, I thought that's where you were heading.
I want to stay on the contrary to law point for now.
Okay. So The our point is simply that our interpretation of the statute is simply that the total expenditures under Part B for one of the specified small manufacturer drugs of the manufacturer. And I think everyone agrees that that refers to a product, not a unit. So the total expenditures for that product means all of the expenditures for that product. Now, Judge Katsas, you suggested that that was might have some counterintuitive results. Mm-hmm. I would welcome the opportunity to explain to you why we think that actually makes sense in light of the statutory purpose.
Okay, so the counterintuitive ones are the December 31st acquisition, where 99% of the stuff is manufactured and sold by the predecessor company.
Absolutely.
And you want attribution of all of that.
Yes. So I think the important thing to remember is that the purpose of this statute, the purpose of the specified small manufacturer definition, is to identify a particular kind of manufacturer, a small manufacturer with a non-diversified Part D product portfolio. When you're evaluating the diversity of a company's product portfolio, it is quite reasonable to do that analysis product by product. Now, we can talk about the edge cases, but just a product-by-product approach is certainly a reasonable way for Congress to approach this question overall. And go specifically to this hypo. Yes, under a product-by-product approach, under your hypo, all expenditures for the whole year for that product count towards the 80% threshold. That result may be counterintuitive, but it doesn't undermine our product-by-product reading for a couple reasons. First, I think at least part of the idea behind that hypothetical is that it seems to allow a manufacturer to gain the system in some way. But it's important to remember that this is a 2022 statute that is keyed to events that occurred beforehand in 2021. So there is absolutely no possibility of gamesmanship here. Congress, by the way it designed the statute, eliminated that possibility. And in fact, for that reason, we know sitting here today that that hypo that you posited won't ever actually happen. The government already knows the entire universe of cases to which this statute will ever apply, and it has already made virtually all of the determinations that this statute will ever require. I do think even if this scenario could happen, it still makes sense.
It's a fair point about gamesmanship, but mm-hmm. you still have a statutory structure that seems to use events in the past as a proxy for, you know, a prospective assessment of, are you small enough and are you non-diversified enough?
I couldn't agree more. And I think that's why the product-by-product approach actually does make sense, even in the hypothetical you gave, the December 31st acquisition. So Congress was trying to determine in 2022 whether, identify manufacturers that are small and non-diversified. It does that by looking back to 2021. Mm-hmm. There's nothing magic about 2021. It's just the last full calendar year on record. So if during 2021, you have a company that has one product that dwarfs the sales of all of its other products, odds are that that product is going to dominate their sales going forward into 2022 as well, mm-hmm. even if they only made one unit. And I think actually, if you've only focused on that one unit, you would really get a misleading picture of the diversity of that company's product portfolio. And I think that's actually exactly what happened here. Servier acquired this product in April. It began manufacturing the product. It was earning revenue from this product because of a quirk of how FDA allows a manufacturer like Servier to use the old manufacturer's labeler code during a transition period. The labeler code wasn't used during 2021, but going into, the sales from that product during 2021 dwarfed everything else they were doing. And going forward into 2022 and forward, when these discounts are actually going to kick in, Tibsovo, again, was still dominating the entire portfolio. So another way to put it, Judge Katsas, would be that the government is suggesting with that hypothetical that our rule is over-inclusive. I think their rule is under-inclusive because it doesn't account for this kind of situation where exactly who this statute was denied for. Servier was small. That's undisputed. That's the specified manufacturer part of the statute. And we clearly had a non-diversified product portfolio going into 2022. It's exactly who Congress
clearly
wanted.
Not manufacturer, as in, if think of manufacturers, is what was sold.
It was made and sold that year to Part D beneficiaries, which is also what the statutory language closely focuses on. What did you make that you sold to Part D beneficiaries? And my understanding from the record is that was made and sold to Part D beneficiaries in 2021 was, I don't know how to say, Agios's pre-existing stock.
So
100% pre-existing stock, which was not in any sense manufactured by, it was manufactured, all done being manufactured before the agreement was inked. And it was then sold to Part D beneficiaries. And what's wrong about that?
So if the analysis is product by product, the only question for this court is, did Servier manufacture the product? And we undisputedly
did.
But
then you want to say, just because two entities here, I'm assuming Agios as well, were small and non-diversified. One of them actually manufactured 100% of the pills that were sold to Part D beneficiaries in 2021. And one came in later to own the rights to those pills, but did not manufacture them. It just said, I've got this pile of pills over here. Let's let it out in the market, so I'll make some money off of it.
So if the analysis is product by product, that doesn't matter. But I take it you're positing that you would interpret
why Congress would. What do you mean? I'm not sure what you mean product by product. The product had to be, by the statutory terms, had to be what was sold, what was manufactured and sold to Part D beneficiaries in 2021. Those are other statutory requirements. That's what Congress was focused on textually. And if it's pre-existing stock, you didn't manufacture something that's already made.
So I think that you're pointing to the manufacturer language in the statute, if I understand your question. And I think that the important textual point on that is that of the manufacturer comes after the words, one of the specified small manufacturer drugs. I think everyone agrees that phrase refers to a product as a whole. And just adding the prepositional phrase of the manufacturer after it does not mean that that one of the specified small manufacturer drugs is some subset of a product. It's still a whole product. It's just a particular kind of product, one that was made by the manufacturer during the year. And Servier undisputedly did make Tibsovo during 2021. I think that the broader question you're getting at, I think, goes to our
Tibsovo. You did not make it, physically make it.
That is
undisputed. And sell it to Part D beneficiaries in 2021. That's the record before us.
Yes, we made units, and those units were not sold until 2022.
Right. But it's about this year, particular year.
And I think the point, Your Honor, is simply that timing quirk doesn't matter if the analysis is product by product. But I see that you may not agree with me on that. So let me explain why we can still win, even if you do disagree with me on that. So I have two answers for you about what we actually did in 2021. One is the actual story of what we did, which is what we would show to the agency on remand if given an opportunity. And the other is what we did, what we already showed the agency based on holding the NDA. So if you're looking at what we actually did and what we'll show on remand if we have an opportunity, we can give CMS the lot number for Tibsovo that was actually dispensed to Part D patients in December of 2021. And then if you trace the manufacturing process for that lot backwards in time, on April 1, 2021, those tablets had been physically pressed, but they weren't labeled and packaged and ready for sale. So what happened was that after April 1st, Servier's contractor put those tablets in bottles labeled and packaged the bottles in boxes and put serial numbers on the boxes. And then later in the year, in 2021, units from that lot were dispensed to Part D patients. So we can draw every single link in that chain. So that is what actually happened and what we can show on remand.
The manufacturer is defined, right? And you have to manufacture and you have to be a manufacturer. And that means that you were engaged in the production. You weren't the preparation. You weren't the propagation. You weren't the compounding. You weren't the conversion. You weren't and the processing. You weren't.
I think we were involved in the in the story that I just told. There's one piece I left out, mm-hmm. which is that Servier personnel reviewed the quality control documentation from the contractor and affirmatively signed.
That was not before the district court.
Correct. That's not before the district court.
That's not before us either.
Correct. I'm trying to answer your question as to what we can show on remand. So if there's a remand, this is what we can show.
I'm just trying to. Whatever you can show on remand is not really of much interest to us because you have to show to get a remand that you are a manufacturer and you made no record. So even assuming that quality control comes, which isn't on this list. But so what did you did not show in this record that you met the definition of statutory definition of manufacturer. You showed that you owned the pills. And a lot of your briefing is clear. You owned the NDA, you owned the pills. You owned the rights for those pills. I get all of that. But owning is not the same as manufacturing. And this is a very specialized definition here that really is focused on, it goes on with, use of chemical synthesis or extraction and chemical synthesis. I mean, it's really talking about the process of making these pills. And am I right that every single pill that was sold in 2021 to a Part D beneficiary was stock that pre-existed the inking of your agreement?
The pills were physically pressed.
Yes.
If you're asking about what the
nothing was manufactured after you took over the rights to this drug in 2021 that went to a Part D beneficiary that year.
Depends on what you mean by manufacturing, but
I mean the statutory definition. It's got to be making it in some way. And if everything that was sold was already made, then you didn't make it.
So let me explain why I think that's not correct. So the tablets were physically pressed before April 1. So that factual premise of your question is correct. We don't dispute that. As the NDA holder, we were legally responsible. And I think there's a very important point here, which is that the government's only response to the argument that the NDA is insufficient is that we didn't preserve it. So this court does not need to get into these merits questions at all. So if we preserve that argument, there's no further dispute about the merits here. But you've asked about the merits, so I want to answer your question.
I don't think they agree that just holding the NDA makes you the manufacturer.
They don't affirmatively agree, but they do not articulate any argument in their brief about why that's wrong.
Because it wasn't. In their view, it wasn't raised below. But there's nothing in the statutory language that cares about who owns, who has legal obligations with respect to. It just doesn't. It's not the statutory language used here. They're focused on the manufacturer.
And so the reason, again, this gets to the merits. So this is only if you reach the merits, and even though the government hasn't argued it, but reaching the merits of this NDA argument, the point is the following. Servier, as the NDA holder, was legally responsible for the labeling, the quality control, and the manufacturing of every unit that was sold after April 1. So, for example, if FDA had determined that the label on units sold after April 1 was missing a warning, for example.
I get all of that. You owned all legal consequences. That's not what they're talking about. What is your best language to say that the definition of manufacturer includes someone who took pre-existing stock, did not make a pill, but had legal responsibility for it? Which word do you put legal responsibility into?
I think we have legal responsibility for all of those words. And here's
there was no more production.
Let me give you
more preparation. There's no more propagation. There was no more compounding. There was no more conversion, and there was no more processing as to those that pre-existing stock.
So what I think Your Honor is suggesting is some kind of act omission distinction, and there are many areas of the law where
I don't think I'm suggesting that at all. But I'm talking. Tell me which word.
So the words in the statute include either directly or indirectly, which I think includes adopting actions taken by others. And I think it's important to this is a situation where it makes which sense action, to hold.
Which action? I'll take your indirectly. Which one did you? Because you had all pre-existing stock.
So we
did you produce it?
Yes.
If it already was produced, how did you produce it?
Because we were responsible for it, and here's how.
Responsible for isn't the same as production. I understand the NDA comes with legal obligations to you, right? If something had been gone, you know, got contaminated in your storage process, you're going to be held responsible for that. Or in your trucking process, you're going to be held responsible for that. That means you're distributing, and you're legally responsible for distribution and maintaining quality control during distribution. That does not make you the manufacturer.
So this is CMS itself disagrees with you on that point, Your Honor. This is not a novel argument. So in two other drug pricing programs, CMS itself today implements a materially identical manufacturer definition to say that it includes the NDA holder. That's the Medicaid drug rebate program and the drug price negotiation program. So
I understand there's other statutory, but that just shows that the language they've used here is very, very particularized.
No, it's materially identical language, absolutely identical. You can look at the statutes. There's no difference between them. And in the Medicaid, in the drug price negotiation program, when they were putting out their guidance on this, on that program, a commenter made exactly this point to CMS. They said, you should use the labeler code, not the NDA holder. And CMS said, no, that's wrong. We disagree. We are going to treat the NDA holder as the manufacturer because that fits with, quote, the FDA regulatory framework. So that's
a statute.
For an absolutely identical statute that is a distinct statute, yes, but the manufacturer definition is identical.
Some of the other ones include things like labeling, packaging, distributing.
It's not the drug price negotiation program. Mm-hmm. The manufacturing definition is exactly the same, Your Honor. If I could pull back from the merits for a moment.
The use of that word manufacturer in the other statutory provisions, the operative provisions.
It uses the word manufacturer, mm-hmm. and the definition of the word manufacturer, which has those six activities, it's exactly the same in the drug price negotiation program as it is in this statute here. And CMS today says that means NDA holder in that program.
That statute, okay.
So you don't think that updating the labeler code has any effect on your arguments when that was a requirement as well?
I'm not fully following your question, Your Honor. I apologize.
Well, it says that you're supposed to update your labeling code, you know, once this agreement changed hands.
I see what you're saying. Yes. So the reason we did not label this inventory that we were selling in 2021 with our labeler code is for a couple of reasons. First, this is common industry practice. In addition, it would have been wasteful to get rid of that stock. In addition, it would have created a break in the supply chain, a break in the supply of this life-saving medicine to patients to have to relabel everything. And importantly, FDA has a longstanding policy that allows manufacturers in precisely this circumstance to use the old labeling during a transition period. That is noted in our recalculation request. That's a JA-112 footnote 3. It doesn't use the word FDA, but that's what that footnote is referring to, is this longstanding FDA policy that allows manufacturers to use the old labeling in these circumstances. So that's why we did it, because we were permitted to do so.
But they don't suggest that they buy that reason, because they're not allowing that rationale to go forward.
Yes, and there was no, I think that goes to our arbitrary and capricious argument, if I'm understanding your question. And so there was no, the denial includes no explanation whatsoever for why the for why CMS was attributing expenditures of Tibsovo to manufacturers based solely on the labeler code. The government's brief tries to fill in that gap in reasoning, but none of their explanations appear in the denial itself. The denial is at JA 119 to 120, and it's just not in there. All the denial says is the guidance and the methodology say to use labeler codes, so we're going to use labeler codes. We told them at the time, we don't think that makes sense here. We're the NDA holder. You should consider using the NDA. And there is no explanation whatsoever for why they didn't do that. And again, this is not an off-the-wall novel idea to use the NDA rather than the labeler code. It's exactly what CMS itself does today in two other drug pricing programs. So at a very minimum, I think you need to set the denial aside and send it back for a new explanation for why they chose this particular proxy, the labeler code, and not the NDA. Mm-hmm. If I could, because there were so many questions about the merits of the NDA argument, I do want to go, I see that I'm far over my time, but I want to go to preservation, but only if it's helpful to the court.
Preservation of the
argument. Of the NDA argument.
Yeah. Okay. I think we have your briefing on that.
Okay.
But we will give you some time on rebuttal as well.
Thank you very much. Morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court, Sean Janda for the federal government. I intended to start this morning with the lead statutory argument pressed by Servier, and in the absence of any contrary direction from the court, I'm happy to start there. I think the easiest way to understand why that argument's wrong is just to substitute the definition of specified small manufacturer drugs for those words in the relevant provision, which the district court did at JA 224 to 25. We did at page 26 of our brief. When you make that substitution, the statute then directs CMS to focus on, quote, the total expenditures under Part D for any one of the drugs that is produced, prepared, propagated, compounded, converted, or processed by the manufacturer. I think once you make that substitution, it becomes clear, again, that CMS is acting fully consistent with the statutory text in focusing on who actually produced, prepared, propagated, compounded, converted, or processed the drugs for which there are Part D expenditures. And I think once you agree with us that that's the right focus, there's just nothing, I think, in the record here.
Where that gets us, doesn't that put us right back in the question of, well, what do you mean by produced? What do you mean by prepared? If we had to, you know, we are now the ones that are in charge. We own it, and we're in charge of it.
So I don't think so, Your Honor. I mean, I think you could imagine an argument if they had made an argument in front of the agency or in front of the district court that says, you know, we did this thing and that thing and the other thing that count as one of these words. They didn't make that argument. And I don't want to get ahead of the agency. If they had made that argument to the agency, you know, I don't know if the agency would have thought that doing the quality control or doing the labeling or packaging the product, which they now say they did, would have counted as one of those words. I just don't know. And so I think sort of once you accept that we're right about the statutory argument, at least as to the one legal argument that I think they have consistently pressed, sort of starting in the agency and through this court, which is that it doesn't matter if they actually manufactured any of the units sold to beneficiaries in 2021. It makes clear they're wrong about that. And then for everything else, I mean, all I think we're in a position to say is that on the record before the agency, we certainly didn't see anything that suggested that they produced, prepared, propagated, et cetera, the actual units sold in 2021. And I think, you know, they now think they could make that showing, but they certainly didn't do it before the agency. And then, I mean, the other thing I'll just sort of say briefly is I think in addition to that kind of clear textual argument, just every feature of the statute focuses on the manufacturer sort of over and over again. It doesn't sort of talk about it. It's very easy to talk about the distributor, the seller, the NDA holder. And it doesn't do that. I mean, it really focuses on the physical process of manufacturing the drugs for which there are expenditures in 2021. And that's where the agency is focused. And again, I think that's just where the administrative submission sort of starting off fall short.
The labor code is not defined in 42 U.S.C. 1395, but you all use that as a way of essentially being a determinative factor as to who's the manufacturer is. So how do you explain that?
Yeah, so the labeler code is given by the FDA to manufacturers, and I think the expectation is that the manufacturer, or in some circumstances, a repackager or relabeler, puts their labeler code on the product. And so what the guidance that CMS applied here says is that, you know, the labeler code is what the manufacturer puts on the product. We're going to use that, I mean, at least as a first pass. You know, I think, again, if
an industry understood term in that regard, that the labeler code is for the manufacturer.
Yes, so labeler codes are given, I think we cite the statute, actually the FDA, not CMS, but the FDA provides labeler codes to manufacturers, I think packagers, labelers, and then the labeler code is going to identify the manufacturer or potentially the repackager, the relabeler. And I think if we had a circumstance where someone came in and said, you know, we actually manufactured this stock, it was then repackaged, and the repackager sort of took off our labeler code and put on their labeler code, but you should give us credit for the stock because we actually manufactured it, the agency might well sort of take a look at that evidence and determine that it's appropriate to disregard.
And then how do you respond to your opposing counsel's arguments with respect to the NDA as opposed to the labeler code?
I mean, I think there's a couple things. I think this is a legal matter. Again, we've been very easy to write the statute to focus on the NDA holder or the owner or the seller. And it doesn't do that. It focuses very much on the physical process of producing, which I think the guidance reflects CMS's determination that the best evidence, or at least sort of the starting point of who did the actual manufacturing is going to be the labeler code. And again, if they come in, they had said, you know, we did A, B, C, D, and E physical things to this product, even though it has someone else's labeler code on it, the agency may well have been willing to engage with that evidence and you know, disregard the labeler code. But that just was not a thing that was ever presented to the agency in this case.
Can I take you back to your plain language argument?
Yeah.
So I'm trying to do on the fly what you suggested, which is plug in the special small manufacturer drug definition into the legally operative text. And I'm going to elide over some things that seem to me clearly immaterial. But so when I do that, I get total Part B expenditures for any drug manufactured by the manufacturer. Fair summary.
I think the first part is right, for any one of the drugs manufactured by the manufacturer.
I came at this with a strong intuition that you have to be right, but just reading those words, and the TIPSIVO was manufactured by the manufacturer in 2021. And then the statute says, what are the total expenditures, total Part D expenditures for TIPSIVO? And there, that seems to not, just those words do not seem to foreclose your friend's interpretation.
Yeah, I mean, so even if you think that they're not sort of foreclosed by the statutory text, I think just every relevant indication of the statute focuses in on sort of particular expenditures for particular drug stock manufactured by a particular entity. And it starts with the expenditures, which I think as Judge Millett observed earlier, that Medicare doesn't make expenditures for a drug line. It doesn't buy TIPSOVO as a product as a whole. It makes expenditures for a particular dispensing of TIPSOVO to particular beneficiaries, mm-hmm. And we really have to focus in CMS's view on those expenditures. I mean, second, I think
yes, in the sense you have to focus in on Medicare expenditures on TIPSOVO, like no question. You can't focus on, you know, Blue Cross expenditure on TIPSOVO, but that doesn't answer the question, you know, one level more granular on sort of, is it Medicare expenditures on TIPSOVO for the pills that the whether the predecessor manufacturer or the successor manufacturer.
Right. I think that sort of the frame of the expenditures puts us talking about particular stock rather than talking about the drug line as a whole. But even if that doesn't do it for you, and I think, again, we have sort of one long definition here. Right. It's all linked together. I mean, as Judge Moss observed, I think Tipsovo sort of tries to break out, or sorry, Servier tries to break out the different pieces of what is really a connected phrase and tries to take them all in isolation, which is not really how the statute reads. I think in addition, as the earlier—
are they trying to do that? I thought they just have a, you heard it, a holistic theory, right? This is about projecting what's going to happen in 2022 and, you know, who owns the drug on— this is not a crazy way. Their reading of the statute is not a crazy way to assess who will be a small and non-diversified manufacturer in 2022 based on, you know, what's happened in 2021.
I mean, I think it does lead to a bunch of anomalies, which I'm happy to talk about. And I think the one that they have sort of managed to explain why they think it's not so anomalous is like maybe the only one where they could say that. But just focusing on, but before I get to that.
I think the December 31st hypothetical.
Right, and I understand the response to that, but if you could—
that seemed to be very anomalous, but the answer, your friend's answer resonated a little bit.
I mean, fair enough, but I think if you flip the hypothetical and make it a single pill on January 1st, and then they divest the line, then you don't have the answer that, you know, well, it will tell you what's going to happen in 2022 because it's right before 2022. But I think it would be the exact same thing. I think they would say if you manufacture a single pill on January 1st, that's then sold to a Part D beneficiary, you are entitled to all of the expenditures for Tipsovo for that pill or for that drug for the year, even though at the end of the year you don't have the line anymore. The other thing I would say is they also would apply in circumstance where throughout the whole year you have multiple manufacturers manufacturing the same drug through licensing agreements or otherwise. And I think, again, there's CMS's view, you know, each manufacturer would presumably put their own labeler code on the stock that they manufactured and would get credit for those expenditures. Again, under Servier's view, I think each manufacturer would be entitled to the total Part D expenditures of all the manufacturers making that same drug, which again, just it doesn't, if you're trying to think about who's small and non-diversified, doesn't map onto the actual manufacturing activities and the drug portfolios. And so I think, again, just CMS's high-level view of how this is supposed to work is just that you match up who actually manufactured the pills with a particular drug manufacturer. You aggregate those together, and then that gives you a sense of the drug manufacturer's both size and diversified or non-diversified status. And moving away from the actual manufacturing of the drugs, I think, would introduce those anomalies.
The way you know, so assume I'm a Part D beneficiary and I get some Tipsovo, my insurance company, to pay for it, or the insurance company intermediary works it. How do you know? I assume it's a labeler code, or no?
So I think if you were trying to figure out who manufactured it, if that's your question,
that's what you have to do. You have to know. You line up all the Part D beneficiaries and all their Tipsovo, right? You figure out who made it,
right?
And then you go back and see if it's diversified or not,
right? And so the first thing that you do, and the first thing that CMS does, is just aggregate all the data. When there's a dispensing of the drug, the sort of pharmacy or whatever fills out a form that includes the labeler code that gets sent back to CMS. And so CMS just sort of starts by pulling the labeler code.
And I assume that's because there's an assumption that the labeler code, you rely on that because that generally identifies the manufacturer?
Correct. And again, as I said, I don't think Servier disputes that in the mine run of cases, the labeler code is going to accurately identify who actually manufactured the product. If there were an odd circumstance where that weren't true, the agency, I think, would have to confront that. I'm aware of, it's not in the record, but I'm aware of at least one manufacturer that came to CMS with exactly that sort of information where they said, though it was someone else's labeler code.
An unusual situation, but
we did the thing and CMS looked at the evidence they submitted and ultimately determined that it should disregard the labeler code and attribute them.
Fine, but you rely on the labeler code. Is the pharmacist reporting who owns the NDA?
I'm not sure what all information is in the prescription drug event records that get sent back to CMS. I know the labor code is there. I just don't know if the NDA holder, unless it's reported on the package, I would assume it would be a thing that they wouldn't report, but I don't want to say that for certain because I have not seen what these records look like.
Right, but it sounds like the way the system is, the way it's set up is, okay, these drugs are getting dispensed. I got to know who manufactured it for purposes of doing this analysis, maybe for other reasons too, but for, certainly for purposes of this analysis, I get the information based on the labeler code. And the labeler code comes up to me, and then we can do the math, figure out who qualifies as the, sorry, the wording of this is a specified small manufacturer.
Correct. And that's sort of how CMS has done it. And the guy, I think there's nothing in the record here, but I think we include CMS into the idea that the labeler code here did not actually identify who had produced, propagated, et cetera, et cetera, the pills that were being sold in 2021.
Can I ask you about the alternative theory? It just seems very clear to me that TIPSIVO was not covered by the CGDP agreement of Servier for 2021. Why doesn't that resolve this appeal?
Right. So I think the problem that we have with that is that my understanding is there is a very long historical practice of CMS that allows one manufacturer to sort of piggyback on another manufacturer's agreement, which it helps ensure, I think, sort of uninterrupted Part D coverage of the drugs when drugs sort of change hands. And so CMS's understanding has been that in a circumstance where one manufacturer is piggybacking on a different manufacturer's agreement, that you sort of treat that piggybacking as the agreement of the piggybacking manufacturer. And so CMS would not, my understanding is, would not have in this circumstance or another circumstance, refused to attribute expenditures to Servier or to another drug manufacturer because they were piggybacking rather than listing the code under the drug on their own agreement.
So it would be just on the facts of this case, April 1 sale, and then by December 1, pills manufactured by Servier are paid for by Medicare, and you want to count those pills.
Right. So for these purposes,
you don't want the lack of the CGDP agreement to disable that attribution.
I think it is that attribution in this statutory context, my very vague understanding.
Just trying to figure out what's the difference between the two theories. Like, where does the difference matter?
So I think it matters for purposes of this particular statutory determination in exactly that context. My understanding is that
the one I just said.
Correct. Where okay. It's still on, but they actually manufacture the pills. Just to be clear, my understanding from the agency is that that there is a fear that it would destabilize if that were read to not permit this sort of look through or attribution of the one manufacturer on the other agreement, that may destabilize other circumstances where the agency has sort of long treated or long permitted that sort of piggybacking, which ensures, again, sort of Part D coverage of drugs uninterrupted in this circumstance where they change manufacturers.
And what's the government's response to Servier's argument about it's normal business not to immediately change the label?
So my understanding, Your Honor, I'm not sure about the regulation that you were referencing. My understanding is that the CMS or FDA, it's probably FDA actually, would not have a problem or does not have a problem with sort of already manufactured pills having the labeler code of that they need to manufacture them, even if they are then bought as pre-existing stock and sold in these circumstances. There's no requirement that the labeler code be updated to reflect a new sort of distributor or seller, which again, I think also sort of underscores that the label or code is added, I think generally at the time the manufacturing happens. And so it's a quite good proxy for the manufacturer rather than for the seller, the distributor, pharmacy, all people sort of further down in the chain, which are not who we think the statute focuses
on. Looking to the labeler code to determine the manufacturer in some instances.
Sorry, I'm saying I think my understanding is that because the labeler code is often put on when the product is manufactured, it is a quite good proxy for the actual manufacturer rather than for the distributor, the pharmacy, the sort of seller further down in the supply chain.
Can you explain to me this, the piggybacking, one more time? Because the way it's described in your brief, it sounds like it's the inverse of this case. So tell me, define piggyback for me.
So my understanding, which comes with all of the usual caveats of my understanding of CMS, is that in a circumstance like where one drug manufacturer has a product on their program agreement or had a product on the program agreement, and then they sell the product line to another manufacturer, as happened here, CMS permits the acquiring manufacturer to piggyback on the selling manufacturer's agreement for the purposes of that drug. And the reason for that is that it ensures there's uninterrupted Part D coverage, because sort of inclusion on a program agreement is a requirement for Part D coverage. And so that there is a desire not to have an interruption in coverage by having to sort of transfer or amend agreements.
But what your footnote says is, thus, if Part D had incurred expenditures, and I could just be misunderstanding, but in 2021, for Tibsovo, that was covered by Agios's agreement, but the Servier had manufactured under its own labeler code, you would go ahead and attribute it to the Servier. But that's not what happened here. Right. Servier didn't manufacture anything under its own labeler code. So your example doesn't fit this case. It fits the opposite.
Right. Sorry. So what we're saying is that if Servier had actually manufactured and produced under its own labeler code, CMS would not treat the fact that they were.
They don't fall within this piggybacking exception.
We do not think that they fall within
the piggyback statutory definition. No, they don't fit within this, your piggybacking policy.
I mean, I think they until they listed on their own agreement, they were piggybacking on Agios's agreement.
But piggybacking would occur, right? Because you already have Tibsovo covered by Agios's agreement. They got the agreement. But if Servier had manufactured under its own label code, then Servier could piggyback on the agreement. But that's not what happened here, in your view, correct?
Correct.
I mean, so then they can't fall within your piggyback exception.
So
why aren't we going back with the statute?
So this may be an imprecision in the way we drafted. My understanding
You talk about Servier manufacturing.
So I think there's...
And using its own labeler code.
Piggybacking for a lot of purposes, piggybacking is not a thing that CMS permits for this purpose only. And so what we are saying is that sort of once Servier is the manufacturer of the drug, has acquired the drug,
I'm sorry, I'm very sorry to interrupt, but you just said two very different things. Once Servier has manufactured the drug, and then you said once they have owned the drug, but those are two very different things.
Correct.
Someone is required to piggyback. Do you have to actually have manufactured? If you're a manufacturer, then you can piggyback on someone else's agreement.
I believe if you own it, you can also piggyback, although I'm not positive about that. And the distinction, just to be really clear, is that that there are a lot of different circumstances in Part D where it's very important that you have a program agreement that covers a particular drug. And so there may be other circumstances where, you know, even if Servier were not manufacturing Tibsovo, it would be important that the Tibsovo that Servier is selling be covered by a program agreement. And at least for those purposes, CMS is willing to let the acquiring manufacturer piggyback on the old manufacturer's agreement until they update their own agreement.
And is this a fair answer to Judge Millett's question, which is, you're not saying that there was piggybacking here. What you are saying is that the rationale of the alternative holding would foreclose piggybacking in other circumstances where you want it to be allowed.
Correct. I think both with respect to this very particular application of determining specified small manufacturers, but also with respect to, again, sort of Part D generally, where the ability to piggyback comes up, my understanding, or came up.
I get the concern. I guess I'm not entirely sure why this whole piggybacking thing is consistent with the statute.
So my understanding, Your Honor, is that
there is a statutory requirement that the drug has to be covered by an agreement of the manufacturer for the year, for that year.
So my understanding is that that is CMS's longstanding practice. I mean, Congress is obviously enacting this provision against the backdrop of that longstanding practice. I think if we were sort of forced to argue about how to interpret the statute, we would rely quite heavily on that pre-existing practice.
Really? We're going to assume Congress understands what this piggybacking thing is when I don't? Struggling with it?
Yeah, I think...
If you can't define it clearly, then we can't assume Congress knew about it.
I mean, I think Congress certainly understands... Well, I think the court can assume that Congress understands the general concept in this case, or at least intends to not upset CMS's long-sale practices in this area. That means, I think for purposes of this court's review, all the court needs to say is that the government is affirmatively waiving the argument. And I do think that the sort of party presentation principles that my friend on the other side discussed are sort of constraining in a way that I think would overcome the usual ability to affirm on grounds sort of not reached by the district court or on other grounds supported by the record. I think in this case, we are telling you we do not think that that is how CMS interprets and applies the statute. It's not something that we would defend. It's not something we would apply in the first instance.
What case says that we assume Congress is aware of agency longstanding practices at this level of obscurity?
I'm not going to be able to cite a case for you for that principle.
Right, so I don't know why we assume Congress legislated again. I mean, you guys could try arguing it. But you're going to have a pretty clear understanding of inconsistent application of piggybacking. And this was a one-year situation here, right?
I mean, again, this was a one-year situation, but just to be, like, really clear about this, mm-hmm. Part D coverage is only available for drugs that are listed on a program agreement. And so my understanding is that, like, from the beginning or close to the beginning, CMS has permitted this sort of, whether it's attribution of one agreement to another to the acquiring manufacturer or sort of allowing manufacturers to have both be considered to be on the agreement in some sense to ensure that when you have drugs moving from one manufacturer to another, that there's not a break in the ability to cover those drugs. And that, I think, comes up in a number of different contexts, not just in this very specialized context. Again, we'd be happy to sort of provide more briefing on that if the court would like it. I think for this court's purposes, though, all the court would need to say is that if it wants to say anything, that the argument has been very affirmatively waived by the government, and party presentation principles would constrain you from reaching it, notwithstanding that waiver. There are no other questions?
I'm not sure we're constrained, but you might have prudential considerations, but anyway.
Any more questions? No. All right. Thank you very much, guys. Okay, Mr. Perdue, we will give you 3 minutes. Thank you. Sorry, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. A couple points. First, I'd like to point, Judge Millett, point you to the FDA's National Drug Code regulations. They are cited on page 13 of our opening brief, and they say that the labeler code in the NDC, it can indicate a person who engages in manufacturing, repacking, relabeling, or private label distribution of a drug. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't necessarily indicate the manufacturer. Here, it actually indicates the private label distributor. There was a question about whether it's a problem that multiple manufacturers could meet the definition for the same mm-hmm. drug or unit. I don't think that's a problem here. That's a feature of the government's reading of the statute. It's a feature of our reading of the statute too. And it's not a problem for either of us because it's not like they're going to be duplicate discounts here. Again, they're not going to be duplicate discounts here. You're not trying to give discounts for historical transactions that happened back in 2021. You're doing discounts moving forward. I think the most important point I want to leave this court with is that You got a lot of detailed explanations from the government today from the podium about how they view the statute. And if you put all of those explanations side by side with the denial that CMS actually issued on JA 119 and 120, there is a huge disconnect. None of the government's explanations appear in JA 119 and 120. So I think the easiest path for this court is to simply remand for explanation from the agency. We told them we own the NDA. We are responsible for the manufacturing. That's how this agency administers identical manufacturer definitions in two other statutes. At a minimum, we were entitled to an explanation for why they were using the labeler code as a proxy instead of the NDA. I think you heard from the government today a couple times that labeler code is at best a proxy or a first cut. They acknowledge the possibility that it could be something else, that another entity could be the one that actually meets the statutory definition.
Because they've already explained that, yeah, but that doesn't matter in this case because as they read the definition of manufacturer, he didn't do it.
But CMS certainly did not say that. CMS certainly did not say that in the denial that they gave us at JA 119 and 120. So I think at a minimum under Chenery, this court
If we think that we can and should resolve all of the legal questions and we do so against you, what's left of the arbitrary and capricious? Seemed like a lot of those points are downstream from the legal dispute.
So I think there's the possibility of when they have to give an explanation of them seeing the light as we see it. I think there was a procedural problem.
Assume you lose on your contrary to law.
I understand.
What's left to be remanded?
So there's the possibility if they're going to use some kind of proxy for the manufacturer, they could use labeler code, but NDA is another possibility and they have to decide which one of those makes sense. I think beyond that, though, I do want to make clear there's a procedural problem here as to why we didn't put in more evidence at the time. At the time, the government told us, the CMS told us they were not open to considering the very information that they are now faulting us for not providing. So that's in the guidance at JA 55. They said that they would consider three things: Medicare Part B claims data, Part D PDE data, and ownership information submitted by manufacturers. That's it. So in our recalculation request, we put ownership information front and center. Then they came back in the denial and said, actually, even that additional ownership information that you gave us, it goes beyond the guidance, it goes beyond the methodology, so we're not going to consider it. They then said the same thing to PharmaCentia when they put in additional evidence that went beyond the PDE data. So now, here in litigation, they're saying, actually, the problem was you didn't give us a different kind of information, information about specific activities that you took with respect to specific TIBSOVO units. If they had told us at the time that they were open to considering that kind of evidence, we could have put it in front of them at the time. And if we are given an opportunity, if there's any kind of remand to the agency, we'll put that before them and they can evaluate it.
Great. Thank you very much, counsel. To both counsel, the case is submitted.
Thank you.